On Motorsport 101, we handle all the tough topics. Should this driver have pitted on a different lap? Should this team have signed a different driver instead? Is this race strategist calling the right things? Is a hot dog a sandwich? We can't answer all those questions, but we can tell you that a hot dog is indeed a sandwich. Because if you're still holding on to this idea that it has to be two separate pieces of bread, then every single Subway sandwich is instead a Subway hot dog. Welcome back to Motorsport 101.
I've never looked at a Subway like a hot dog before, and now that will never be able to leave my head. Welcome back to episode 347 of Motorsport 101. I'm your friendly neighborhood host, Dre Harris. Glad you could join us. And in the first of three episodes, a triple header we got over the course of this, probably the busiest weekend of motorsport we'll probably ever cover in 2022, where all three of our main series were on at once. We are going to be talking IndyCar's XPEL 375 up first. Yes, that's one for you all the American listeners out there. Yes, we're covering IndyCar first. You're welcome. So, as we go around the horn on this one. First up, RJ O'Connell. Hello, sir. How's it going?
Hello, folks. There's a different kind of footlong out there, and this is a different kind of race that we're going to be talking about today. I feel you can't see it because, again, our ability to be a podcast is visual media destroyed, but I'm wearing my Joseph Newgarden, my CFH racing era Newgarden shirt that I've had for years, just to celebrate, because I wanted to put the word out that we're back up.
He is indeed back up. More on that very shortly. Also with me, Ryan Eric King. Hello, sir.
Yes, I've survived an epically long weekend of motorsport, because I think Sunday from the MotoGP race was scheduled to start at around 3 a.m. Eastern time, and then by the time the IndyCar race was done, it was around, 4, 5 in the afternoon. It was a long day.
I think we both did a bit of NASCAR as well at one point or another as well. So, it was even later. I was going to oversleep. So, actually, I was lucky in the sense, thank God the MotoGP race actually got delayed for an hour. That actually gave me time for my body clock to catch up. But, yeah, it was a long old day. More news episodes coming up later on this week. But Cam is not with us this week. But he's been knocking on the door for literally some time, asking to come back on the show. We finally gave in. He's the IndyCar co-editor at Front Stretch and the general nuisance of our Discord server, if the intro wasn't proof enough already. Chris DeHarde is back, everybody. Hello, Chris.
Hello, everyone. Sometimes a little bit of chaos can be nice. And I got that as I was leaving Dallas. Actually, on getting to and coming away from Dallas, I covered the race from the media center for Front Stretch and did a couple of other things for Motorsport Magazine as well for their online online dealings. And it was weird. Jennifer Fryer posted a tweet thread the morning of the race saying that she felt like it was more of a tire test because she didn't hear that much promotion about the race. And looking back, you could tell she's kind of right about that. I will say this. The people that were there were very passionate about it. I saw a lot of people in the garage area, mostly hanging around some guy named Jimmy Johnson, who was some NASCAR driver, I think, at one point.
Yeah, he's won a few races. But,
Victory Lane's named after him. But there were a decent amount of people there in the paddock area during the weekend. I hope that this race doesn't go away.
We'll get to that.
We'll get to that.
And also, I'm also glad that you were able to get back after it seemed like it was going to storm all throughout Texas after the weekend.
Well, but going back to before the weekend, I had visibility issues with the plane. I was going from Indy to New York City hiking, back to Dallas, and then I had to get rerouted to Buffalo, hi to RJ's favorite team. And then on my way back, we had tornado warnings, and there were sirens going off all over DFW. But no, the turbulence didn't get the plane down. And, yeah, everything was just fine. And I'm even so lucky that the rental car economy light at the airport didn't charge me an extra day because I didn't leave till 12:30 in the morning. But, yeah, everything's good.
Ah, hell yeah. I love getting an extra free day in the rental car.
Well, but the economy light, it's the economy light. It's $9 a day to park there. I mean, you could argue it's after midnight, but no, that was good.
True. True that. Right. We'll get into the IndyCar Expo 375 right after we remind everybody where they can find us. All of our details are on our website, motorsport101.com. If you want to check out some extra visual highlights and some bonus content, check out our YouTube page, youtube.com/motorsport101, or on facebook.com/motorsport101. We're on Twitter at motorsport_101. If you want to follow our personal handles, you can at Harrison101HD, at RJ O'Connell, at Ryan Eric King, and at Cedar Harday if you want to follow Chris on there as well. Check him out if you haven't already. He sometimes goes more than 3 tweets without cracking a joke, which is a better rate than me. So, yeah, he's definitely worth a follow. So check that out if you haven't already. Give him a nice little Motorsport 101 bump from us. It's been a while. We're on Instagram at Motorsport101Pod if you want to check us out on there for all the latest content we put out on the website as well. And if there's also our Patreon info out there as well, patreon.com/motorsport1 if you want to back us, all sorts of levels, all sorts of bonus perks on there. Check it out if you haven't already. Right, let's get into the IndyCar Expo 375. So, definitely a tale of two races in Texas. You look back at the score sheet and one thing leaps off the page. Scott McLaughlin led 186 laps of this race. It was a 248 lap over race. That's exactly 75% of the race was led by Scott McLaughlin. Only to lose 500 yards from the line. Joseph Ugarten, so shall we say, out-Scottied Scotty, which is quite the thought. It was a pretty quiet 150, but the last 100 laps, well, pretty exciting stuff. Everyone in Penske going at it. Ganassi was involved. Rinus VK was involved. Marcus Ericsson, I think, got his first podium finish on an oval as well. So, yeah, this was definitely a mixed bag in Texas over the course of the race. So, gentlemen, I ask you first and foremost, what did you make of the change in dynamic during the race? And, well, this race was kind of overshadowed by the future of this race. Is it still worth going here despite the ongoing problems with the PJ1?
Oh, goodness. So I know they did a lot of changes to this race in the lead-up to try and make this a bit more like classic IndyCar at Texas, which is a bit nerve-wracking at times, admittedly, but you can't deny that the racing was entertaining, and let's not forget that this is one of the few places during the split on the Indy Racing League side that, apart from Indianapolis, could reliably put six figures worth of people in. So there's a number of different things that they did. They added optional barge boards to add more downforce to the car if you need it. They've actually started to just... What they've done is that they're trying to replace the PJ1 traction compound that you see that's just smeared all up over the top of the corners. Mm. They're trying to replace that with a new resin traction compound that's less detrimental to the Indy cars. And I think the big thing is that Will Power was like hammering IndyCar for this, and he got it. They got him 30 extra minutes, a voluntary practice session to try and rubber up that outside line through the corners so that more people could actually like race wheel to wheel. And by the second half of the race, they definitely did it. The second half of the race, I'll say, much, much better than the first. First half of the race, I was just like thinking, God, am I going to have to sit through another one of these snoozers? And by the end, it was just like, okay, all right, this is great. But so quality of the race aside, the quality of racing, I think, definitely passed the test. But King, you know, and I know that it's not always about quality of racing that determines an IndyCar's venue's future on a calendar.
Yeah, well, yeah, aside from the quality of racing, which it certainly helped out, because I think for the most part, in terms of rubbering up the outside lane, it eventually did work, especially like some parts where like the PJ1 goes through the corner exit all the way, and like you could really tell it affected how you race the track on the exit of four, where you really have to stay down low a real long time. But in terms of the people who came out to see the race, those stands look real sparse, and even people at home decided not to watch, where the race didn't pull in more than a million people on network television. And that's compared to over a million people watching the F1 race that, you know, started just about an hour and a half before the IndyCar started.
And even on free to air.
Yeah, it wasn't even on free to air. It was on ESPN. It was on cable television. And it was the most watched F1 race on cable since 1995. And it was the most watched F1 race, period, in the U.S. since 2018. It outperformed even the free to air races on ABC.
That's mighty impressive. I mean, I did look at those numbers as well. 18 to 49 demographics, very similar to NASCAR's as well. So, yeah. Definitely some positives to take away from F1. We'll talk more about that, obviously, later in the week. But me personally, I mean, yeah, this definitely was a tale of two races. The first 120 laps or so were a cure for insomnia, to say the least. It wasn't great. McLaughlin had like a 15-second lead at one point. It looked like he was going to run away with it. Cautions did come. We'll get to those later. But like the second half was awesome. Once we finally got some green racing in, we had this brilliant blend of cars jostling for track position, cars trying to make the narrow line work. I mean, you had enough room on the corners for two cars and maybe a cigarette paper, basically. But you had guys either fighting for track position, trying to save some fuel where they could, because it basically became a one-stop race for those final 100 laps, which I'm pretty sure we're green to the end, if memory serves. But yeah, like it was awesome to watch. It was fantastic. The final two-thirds of that race was great. And look, the finish was awesome. Like it was straight out of Hollywood. I mean, McLaughlin, who had led three quarters of the race, looked like he was virtually unstoppable the whole way through, and gets traffic on the final lap, and then Newgarden throws the Hail Mary around the outside and wins. It's straight out of, like, it's anime stuff. You got to watch it to be there. 0.067 of a second between them. It was a fantastic finish. Glad that they were able to talk it out afterwards. And yeah, very much an interesting sign for the future that McLaughlin was genuinely pissed off for about 5 minutes that, yeah, he felt like he probably blown that one, even though he drove superb.
My, how shit changes in a year.
Oh, yeah, man. Like you wouldn't believe. Chris, what did you make of it, man?
So, for me, it's about experience. McLaughlin, if he had another decade of experience like Joseph did, he would have gone to the outside no problem, and he would have won that race. And he would have gotten himself closer to that $1 million bonus for winning a race on a road course, a street circuit, and an oval. He would have been two-thirds of the way there.
Good point.
So, and for those that don't know, there is a $1 million bonus that IndyCar is paying out to a driver who can win on a road course, a natural terrain road course, a street circuit, and an oval. Half of that will go to the driver and team. Half of that will go to a charity.
Why don't they tell us about this?
There was a preseason press release about this.
There was a release the week before St. Pete, but I guess it just didn't catch a lot of people.
Stuff like the Wisdom Million. But yeah, Chris, you were there. This looked like especially towards the end, it was fun, and yeah, just Joseph's experience.
Yeah, Joseph has a decade of experience that has helped him on ovals that he could draw from to make that pass on the outside of McLaughlin. Just needs some more time on ovals to be able to do that kind of thing. I actually asked this question in the post-race press conference. If 2012 or 2013 Joseph Newgarden was leading that race in McLaughlin's place, would he have done the same thing? He said, yeah. Great question. Having that experience would help. Help that. But yeah, after the three-car incident that we'll talk about later, the rest of the race was all green flag. And it was kind of interesting to see how the drivers were going back and forth with the lead, with the way the fuel strategies were working out. And then you had Rinus leading for a while, but then the crew said that we need a yellow, otherwise we won't make it. And he ended up losing, I think, four spots near the end. But yeah, McLaughlin, I think his personality and what he showed everybody there, more people are going to like him. And yeah, I'm not happy that he, you know, fell at the end because I wanted to see someone get closer to that prize. But I am happy to see that him and Joseph were able to talk it out.
Yeah, they've got good camaraderie, those two. I enjoyed like them hugging it out in victory lane afterwards. That was so cool.
That was very cool. Very cool. Very cool.
And McLaughlin got the $600 in cash.
Very much so.
$600 in cash, and they decided because someone at Penske was having a birthday and they were going back to Charlotte that night, that they were debating the idea of spending it at one of a number of fine adult entertainment establishments in the Charlotte Metroplex. But that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, I don't think that was going to happen. Joseph supposedly had to go to a PPG appearance in Pennsylvania that night, but I don't know if he even made it because of the storms that were taking place in Dallas. Because, as you know, when you win an IndyCar race, there's all these post-race media obligations.
Oh, yeah. As you do. Right, one of the guys, we've got to talk about one of the guys who was coming up through the field and was getting quite a large amount of airtime over the course of that second half of the race.
Is it time for the propaganda machine to cash in?
Yes, it is time. Hit the button. Yes. Hey. Yeah, this is the moment you. It's. I don't know whether it was a good or a bad thing that Lee Diffie said on commentary as the race was going down. Jimmy Johnson is in the top 10. It's the first time he's been able to say that since he got to IndyCar. And I'm like, oh no. But Jimmy Johnson, sixth place in his first oval race.
Pace alone.
On pace alone. No shenanigans. All frills. And, I mean, Chris, what did you make of it all watching it? Because, I mean, how could you not root for Jimmy going up the field like that towards the end?
I was hoping. So my expectations for Jimmy Johnson were, I've heard that he's turned something like 11,000 laps at Texas.
It's crazy.
Yeah, so he knows his way around the place. I was figuring, okay, let's go for top half of the field here. Let's see, 13th and up, all right? And then we got to like 11th place. I'm like, you know, maybe a top 10 is actually, you know, on the cards here. And then he gets to like 9th place, and I'm like, I wonder if he can get 6th or 7th to get in the top quarter of the field. And then all of a sudden, I have the lap chart in front of me here. He gets to 5th place on lap 234 going around Simon Pagenaud, and I'm like, what? Like, that just happened here? And then Pagenaud got around him on 235, but then Johnson got him on 236. And in the interviews on pit road after the race, he said that there was a telemetry issue. The team and him did not know how much fuel he had saved. And so in a panic, he went to a lower fuel map, and Scott Dixon got by him on lap 246, and Johnson finished 6th after running the last three laps in 6th place. A couple of stats on Jimmy Johnson. He made 21 passes, 17 of those for position. I believe 7 of those were in the top 10, and 2 of those were in the top 5. Jimmy Johnson ran well, and it was all about him getting comfortable with the car. As the tires wore off and the fuel burned down, his car was, you know, sliding a little bit on the used rubber, and it really made him understand how he could actually drive the car in the corners. And I'll just say it right now, it might help him on road and street courses now that he knows how that car will handle at higher speeds. Now, I'm not going to go as far as Jeff Gluck did and say he might win the Indy 500, because there's a whole lot that goes into that. Ask J.R. Hildebrand. But I think he has a legitimate shot at getting a top 10 in the Indy 500 next month, assuming, of course, that he makes the race.
It's like, RJ, what do you reckon, RJ?
Just to add to something that Chris said, yeah, he ran solidly in the top 10. There was a lot of attrition in this race early on, but to his credit, he did not become the attrition. I believe he might have even dodged a wreck here or there. He dodged two wrecks, which obviously goes a long way in helping. Once he got towards the front, like, this is the Jimmy Johnson that they've been advertising since he got here. This is the Jimmy Johnson that we were hoping to see. He finished ahead of your reigning series champion, Alex Palou. There's obviously a lot that goes into that, but that was a good performance, and I'm not going out of my way to pick him for the Indianapolis 500, but it wouldn't surprise me if he has if he is in the mix by the end of the race. If he does end up winning it, oh my god, could you imagine?
Oh, Lord. I wouldn't be surprised if he just retired on the spot if he won the 500.
We're done here. We're not topping this.
There are two scenarios where he retires on the spot. He misses the 500 or he wins the 500.
If he wins, he'll pull a Sam Hanks.
I haven't got much to add on all of this besides... Who wasn't rooting for Jimmy on that one? I mean, it's easy to forget, despite all of this and his nazis. The man is 46 years old. Okay, yeah. He is 46 years old. This is only what, his 17th IndyCar race or 18th IndyCar race or something along those lines, and first time on an oval. And again, like, he looked like he'd been doing this for years. Well, he has, but just not in that type of car. But these were not scrubs he was passing. This was, like I said, it was Alex Palou and Simon Pagenaud, who's won everything you can win in this series.
It's one thing if you're like racing wheel to wheel with like Dalton Kellett.
Yeah.
No offense to Dalton Kellett, who seems like a very nice guy.
Yes.
But he is. You're passing Palou and Pagenaud. This is a whole step up.
There was a great scene at the end of the race where he and Scott Dixon are just talking it up at the end after the race had finished, and you look and they go, those are probably America's two best racing drivers of the 21st century right there, just talking it out after having a fight at 230 miles an hour around an oval. One not being a surprise at all, and the other one, would you have guessed that 2 years ago that Jimmy Johnson would be racing Scott Dixon on an oval in IndyCar? Both of them over the age of 40. I mean, that's just it was awesome. It was wonderful, and if you're an IndyCar fan, you have to be rooting for Jimmy here. Like, it is a win-win for everybody if Jimmy is good, right? And he was great here, and I'm with Chris. I think top 10 is doable. Like I said, if he leads a handful of laps, if he's in a leading group during the 500, there's going to be a lot of eyeballs on it, and that would be a huge dub for IndyCar if that was to happen. And yeah, like, that is our next oval race. You know, we got to get to May. It's going to be a long process, and of course, there is no guarantees he makes that race. We've seen how ruthless bump they can be and has been in recent years, and I'm sure 2022 will be no exception. But that was fun, and that was fun.
That was wholesome. And yeah, just really great to see a relatively inexperienced IndyCar driver thrive in their first Super Speedway oval race. And now we're going to flip this on its head because of our rookie class. I think, like, God, only two of our rookies finished, but one of them, Devlin DeFrancesco, oh my goodness. He found himself involved in three separate incidents that led to cautions mid-race. He didn't touch Kyle Kirkwood, but he washed Kirkwood up into the marbles and Kirkwood wrecked. Takuma Sato, same thing. It didn't really touch, but Sato washed up and he wrecked.
There was smoke between the two of them. There was contact.
There was contact.
It was a light touch. And then Devlin DeFrancesco played himself. He drives in three wide into turn three with Graham Rahal and Elio Castroneves beside him. All three of them wreck. Thankfully, everybody is okay. So, on the flip side of the coin from Jimmy Johnson, Ryan Eric King, number one Devlin DeFrancesco fan, what'd you make of that performance?
So, we hadn't had to talk about this on the show yet. Like, it's a running thing on the Discord server, but it hasn't come up on the show. When RJ says I'm a Devlin DeFrancesco fan, he's saying that ironically.
And why would he be saying that ironically in this case, King?
No.
You even though Save the Freedom 100.
And dump is the nice way to say that. Just simply drove his car into mine and we both wrecked.
SiRacing.com, baby. Premium motorsport simulation.
Oh, and dear.
Honestly, in that moment, I was shocked that an actual racing driver would do something like that. Though Devlin did have, you know, somewhat of a history of doing this during his brief time in the F3 European Championship. I'd assume that, you know, moving up to the big cars, racing at Texas Motor Speedway, you're averaging like 118 miles an hour in race conditions. You wouldn't do something like that in a real race.
A little faster than that.
Oh, yes, a little faster than that. But, you know, you're going those insane speeds. You wouldn't just dive bomb someone like that, especially in a three-wide scenario, because, and, you know, if you do take a three-wide and you know you're heading into a two-lane corner, you're going to back out of it, right? You're not going to stick it and, like, think you can get the move done through the corner, right?
Right? Oh, it's like...
I'll just say it right now. Sometimes you need to have a little bit more experience on super speedways and open-wheel cars. Is there a way for us to do that with the junior-level cars, everybody?
We could definitely stand to have more ovals on the road to Indy. I do get... Yeah, and the thing about Texas is... If there is any track that skews more towards having bulk experience, it's this place. Because, like, I swear a lot of the guys that run up front have probably raced on the IRL side of the split when that was a thing.
Yeah,
like, the only person up front who didn't race on the IRL side of the split I could think of off the top of my head was Will Power, but...
Will's built different, and he's been flying his... He's been really working hard to become the new oval master of the sport.
Yeah. Look, I don't want to be too mean to a rookie, and, you know, I actually was pleasantly surprised at how modest that Rahal and Helio was after the third incident, because they interviewed them both when they got out of the medical center. And, like, those two men have had, you know, a knack of speaking their mind over the years when angry. And Rahal was actually quite measured. Look, the kid's got a bright future, but you can't do that, man. Yeah. Basically. And Helio was, you know, a bit miffed. You know, he had the very funny, angry, like, uncle point to the camera. But I think he just understood, look, it's a rookie. It happens. But look... You can't do that. I mean, there were three separate cautions that you were all responsible for. Like, that's rare. Like, we didn't even get that at Nashville last year, where we had one person responsible for three separate cautions. I mean, that's just it's not great. And look, we knew what this was going in Texas. Like I said, like, the lanes for the corners really was two cars at a push. You could just about get two through the path. You know, that was obvious by the time we'd gotten to the point of the race where Devlin was at. Why on earth are you trying a three wide? Like, that was never going to work in a million years.
Even if he didn't put the car in the apron and he was able to make it through the corner, he was pretty much putting Elio in a position where he was going to go into the wall regardless of what happened.
And Elio ran in that upper groove in the voluntary practice session that we'll get into later on, but I'm just sitting back here thinking, you know, if Devlin's car doesn't wash up a total of about 2 feet between all three incidents, he probably finishes the race.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what it was in all those cases. It just washed up about a half to a quarter of a lane each time. Although, like, the third accident, let's face it, he was, part of the tire was on the apron. There's nothing you could do about that.
Yeah, but like part of it in the post medical center interview, he says that there was nothing he could do to prevent the car from washing up. When, like, I don't have any real world experience in these cars. But there's something easy you could do to prevent a car from pushing up the track corner exit. Lift. Like, it's not...
Slow down.
Yeah.
Even I know that. Like, just... you're going at 225 miles an hour around these corners. Like, learn to fight another day. Like,
yeah, and I'm not saying that he has to lift off the throttle completely. Like a half lift, quarter lift, just anything to get the front to bite.
Yeah, just this is a race
where you could really, like, where you really had to kind of pick your spots to overtake, because as we alluded to, there was a lot of like single file running and a lot of fuel saving during spats of the race, and you know that's fine. I didn't find that as egregious as like the stop start nature of like the second quarter of the race. But yeah, that's got to come with experience. And I'm sure Devlin knows that. And God, we'll get into it. But God bless America. That was just emblematic of a bad, bad Sunday afternoon for one team in particular.
Oh, dear. It was ugly. It was ugly for, you know, two big name teams in the field. And we'll get into a little bit of that now, actually, because there's something I did notice looking at the results page and looking at the race as immediately as it ended. Top seven, all the Penske's. First, second, and fourth. You know, Newgard, McLaughlin, and Power in fourth. And then 3, 5, 6, and seven, all four Chip Ganassi cars. And Ericsson was the first of them over the line. I still can't believe that. You know, I shouldn't be so surprised at this point because like Marcus was genuinely good last year, but that was, I think, I'm pretty sure that was his first podium on an oval. But you know, Ganassi's cars were 3, 5, 6, and 7. So the top seven featuring pretty much all seven of arguably the two best teams in the championship. Gentlemen, do you think this is the fight for the 2022 championship right here and now, between probably six of these seven cars?
I gotta tell you, my preseason pick of Colton Herta lifting the Astor Cup is not looking good. Let's just rip the band-aid off. Andretti Autosport had a wretched weekend. It started when Alexander Rossi hit with a jump start penalty for moving out of his lane on the start, has his car shut off. During one of those cautions for a wreck involving Devlin DeFrancesco and somebody else, Romain Grosjean's turbo just fucking exploded under caution, and his Super Speedway Oval debut ends before the halfway mark.
Yeah.
And then Devlin crashes out, and then just to add a little extra insult to injury, Colton Herta, who's on track for a legitimate top five finish, has finger trouble on the left front on the final pit stop, and it knocks him off the lead lap.
To quote Shannon Sharp, one of the greatest TV commentators of all time, to say that Andretti Autosport struggled at Texas is a disrespect to struggling. When we look at, and make sure I'm understood correctly when I say this, every race team wants to do very, very well whenever they are competing. It's just, you know, you don't have to say it. You know, it's like, oh, some people want it more. Colton Herta finished 12th. The other three Andretti Autosport cars out of a 27-car field finished 24th, 26th, and 27th.
Oof.
And Rossi...
Once again, it is Meyer Shank Racing who have the best Andretti technology cars in the field with Simon Pagenaud.
And what's frustrating, though, is, you know, Alex Rossi finishing last. As I always said this in the media center, if it weren't for bad luck, he wouldn't have any luck. He just... I don't know what it's going to, what you can do. The cartoon anvil that Marshall Pruitt references frequently has just not let up for them at all. And I hate it for them because you know full well how many sponsors they have, the partnerships that they've generated, all the preseason buzz with Romain Grosjean being there, Colton Herta being a legitimate championship contender, and this happens?
The cars are quick. Yes! Don't get me wrong, the cars are quick, but that's not good. And if on the subject of cartoon anvils, King, I know you were down on McLaren SP going into the season. At least a little down. What the hell was that? Felix Rosenquist wins the pole. He's finally saying, right, you're not going to kick dirt on my IndyCar career. I have taken pole position. And then he drops out of the race with a mechanical failure. Pato O'Ward clips one of his crew members in the pits, and that obviously wasn't good. And I'm glad to hear that crew member is doing well, not injured from the contact, but another lackluster weekend for McLaren. Hey, their luck from Bahrain finally kind of followed them over to Texas. Yuck.
Oof. Yeah, oh, that was where it feels like the thing I talked about with, well, in the season preview about, you know, McLaren, they might be able to put a fast car together, but operationally, this team's got problems.
And there's already rumors about that Pato O'Ward may be thinking about looking for the exit door.
Yeah, that's kind of what happens when Zach may or, you know, maybe or maybe doesn't sign one of his direct competitors as a development driver. You know, after telling them out for 2 years.
We'll probably talk about this more on the F1 side of things, but yes, since the last time IndyCar raced, Zach Brown has signed Colton Herta to an F1 development deal at McLaren.
I'm not waiting for Michael to get that entry slot.
By the way, worth noting, Felix Rosenquist, I think it was a right rear drive shaft that might have had an issue. It was definitely at that corner of the car, but Rosenquist not winning makes it a 14-race streak in a row where the pole sitter at Texas has not won the race.
Damn.
Yeah. Yikes. And Pato, because he hit pit personnel, they had to replace the nose on the car, and he had to restart the back of the field for that caution, which was actually the one for Sato and DeFrancesco's collision.
Ugh, yeah. Okay, but it can't all be bad. It can't all be bad, because Penske Ganassi, though, Penske and Ganassi are looking good.
No. And it's not like Penske and Ganassi look good. And yes, McLaughlin might have, you know, won the first race, almost won the second race. It's certainly not the Scotty show. They're definitely, he's not going to be the only person in contention for wins. It feels like, you know, everyone at the top two teams, yes, including Jimmy Johnson, could win a race this season.
Yeah, if the right oval falls Jimmy's way, like, I mean, why not, right? I mean, Marcus Ericsson just finished third. Like, I mean, he was in contention for the win for a good chunk of that race, and we don't expect Marcus to be up there on ovals, and yet there he was. He just keeps finding a way to rack up these top 10s.
That was vintage Kenny Brack from Marcus Ericsson. That was out of his one-time mentor's playbook.
At St. Petersburg this year, Marcus told me that there was a lot that they had to work on in the offseason. He finished sixth in the championship last year. I asked him, what was his main thing he had to work on? He said ovals. Double points at the 500. He missed some points at Gateway. And he said that the difference between running in 10th on an oval and running for the win is a very large gap. This right here shows that the work that the Ganassi team put in, especially with him, has paid off.
Yeah, the next time he wins, it ain't going to be no fluke.
No. And yeah, I mean, we've barely even mentioned it as well. A salute to the captain. His 600th win across decades of motorsport for Roger Penske. 600 wins across the board.
Different decades and countless championships. 600 wins. That's a lot of wins.
Yeah, that is nuts. Yeah. Like I said, given Penske have not fared the best on ovals in the last couple of years or so, to get their cars 1, 2, and 4 is very, it's virtually perfect. I mean, it's almost literal perfection. I mean, that was brilliant driving from all of their team. Ganassi, look, Alex Palou is doing exactly what he did last year. goes about his business, unassuming, didn't look special at any point in the weekend, finishes sixth. Perfect. Like, can't say any more than that. If it's not your weekend and you're still finishing sixth, you're doing something right, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, like, it looks like these two teams are a cut above. Andretti still looks like an overstretched mess at the moment, by the looks of it. I know mechanical problems are mechanical problems, but, you know, having a botched pit stop and just to throw in the pile as well was a write-off. McLaren, you know, Pato, again, wasn't particularly great all weekend. Felix finally does have a good qualifying session. And again, Carl lets him down to a degree. It's all been a bit of a mess in that midfield right now. And yeah, cream rises to the top in IndyCar like it has a knack of doing. And yeah, Penske and Ganassi, I think it's going to be one of these. I think it's going to be one of these mainline six, definitely. And as King alluded to, I definitely think that Johnson's got a shot to win a race if circumstances allow. We've seen many a crazier thing on an IndyCar oval. I wish we had more IndyCar ovals, to be honest with you.
Yeah. But it just goes back to that thing. Like, regardless of quality of racing, how safe a track is or isn't, if you're not putting asses in seats, there's going to be less incentive for people to go. Like, we talk about, like, there's a video out there that described the 2015 California race as the best race nobody watched, and it hasn't been on the calendar since.
Yeah. And, like, and the thing is, the big draw for IndyCar to run at ovals for the past, well, the past decade and even longer, was, besides getting people into the track itself, on average, oval races get bigger TV audiences than road courses, and that advantage is getting smaller and smaller each and every year IndyCar stops running more and more ovals.
If Texas Motor Speedway is fortunate to come back onto the calendar, because we know, like, you know, Circuit of the Americas is, like, gunning for that regional slot on the calendar. They want that back. They do not want to be a one-and-done deal. But if Texas Motor Speedway comes back, they got to do something to get the fans back in. I don't know whether that's put it back in prime time, put it in a different slot on the calendar, bundle it up with a concert to get other people to come.
Can I have a four, please?
Absolutely.
Sure.
So
sure.
When it comes to this race, promotion is one of the biggest things that we need to find in IndyCar nowadays. When we look at the Hy-Vee company, they're a grocery chain out of Iowa, and they have completely gone all out gung-ho on the Iowa doubleheader. They've got, like, different country acts. I forget who all they have, but they have a bunch, like, was it Gwen Stefani?
Yeah, they're turning into music festival.
I think that, to me, that's the problem, that IndyCar relies on their partners to do the promotion for them when no other league does that. Even the NFL, the behemoth of American sports, still runs TV ads promoting the NFL itself.
Yeah, and you look at them, not just that, but you also look at the people over at Gateway, Curtis Francois, Chris Blair, John Bisci, and all of them, the Bomberito Automotive Group. They put in a lot of work and just old school promotional stuff with posters and billboards and everything else to try and get people to go to that race. And it works. But when you go to Texas and you know, Big Hoss, the humongous TV on the backstretch, has like a 20% of its bulbs are not working and it's pixelated all to hell, when that was a major selling point of the track. And then to hear, this is from a fellow writer's family, that concession stands where they were sitting at were not staffed, when restrooms had no power to them. It's like, what's going on here?
This is supposed to be the crown jewel of motorsport in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, a market that is still profitable. I know Texas Motor Speedway has had a troubled history, to say the least. Like, NASCAR fans will tell you, this place is a bit of a white elephant, but you'd be stupid to give up on that market entirely, but they got to apply themselves.
Yeah, it's to that point where I said that's the problem, where IndyCar needs to promote itself to the point where IndyCar going to a place is a draw, and that promoters pretty much don't feel like, well, we paid the sanctioning fee, IndyCar is going to show up regardless. They have to feel that, hey, IndyCar leaving would hurt us.
Yeah.
Dallas is the fourth largest media market in the country, and to lose this event would be a massive blow. I mean, when you look at the top five media markets in the country, Dallas is number four. They have Texas Motor Speedway. Los Angeles is number two. They have Long Beach, which is a great event. I'm going there in a few weeks. I can't wait. But they also had Fontana, and we all know what happened with that. And then you look at number one, New York. Well, they had Watkins Glen, which is a few-hour drive away, but it's still, you know, a drive a day. And Pocono, which is, what, King, what, 2 hours away?
Right? Yeah, 2.5 hours away. Like, technically, it's like it's on the border of New York's media area.
And then you get the third largest market in the country, Chicagoland. There's Chicagoland Speedway, which is about, what, hour and a half it's away rotting. From Chicago?
Chicagoland Speedway was built 20 years ago, and it's rotting.
Exactly. Yeah. And then the fifth largest market is Houston, and they had the street race out there, which...
Yeah, they just raced up in the parking lot of the Astrodome.
That's the thing. Terrible. Where you say that IndyCar leaving would hurt IndyCar. That's pretty much an environment where the promoters are not going to do anything, and pretty much if they do promotion work, like, you know, the Bomberitos do at Gateway, it's because they care about IndyCar, not because it's profitable. They care about IndyCar. They're doing it out of generosity.
As much as I hate to say it, because a lot of people want to clown on him, you know who else cared for IndyCar? Eddie Gossage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fair enough. Eddie Gossage may have been a bombastic idiot, but he cared about having IndyCar at that track to the point that he was willing to shut Circuit of the Americas out for, in a sense. But we'll see what happens. I definitely understand that like, I didn't want to be right in saying, like, this event served no purpose other than to appease people nostalgic for a certain area of the sport. But because it turned out to be a good race, I worry that this is a day late and a dollar short. To close us on something a little more positive, man, Kyle Kirkwood on restarts before he got knocked out of the race. 10 cars passed at 45 minutes. I know we're riffing a bit, but good grief, that was good. That was great. Great at the 500.
I look forward to that. King Kirkwood, indeed. Our second king on this fine motorsport podcast. That was Texas, everybody. Then it was a fun time. I hope we come back. IndyCar will be back on April 10th in 3 weeks' time at Long Beach, back in the April slot. Maybe that will resurrect Alex Rossi's bad run of form. Until then, basically, you can find us one more time, YouTube and Facebook.com/Motorsport101. We are on Twitter at Motorsport_101. Personal handles one more time, at Harrison101HD, at Ryan Eric King, at Chris DeHardy, and at RJ O'Connell. Motorsport101 pod for our Instagram page, and all the details and written stuff. So a little bit more from me as well on what I thought of Texas, as well as everything else this weekend, because I had to do three of those over the course of the weekend. F1, MotoGP, and IndyCar, all of that on the blog section. Check it out, motorsport101.com. All of that is over there as well. We'll be back a little bit later on in the week to talk Formula One in Bahrain, and to your shock, the winning car wasn't silver or purple. I know, shocking, right? Until then, I've been Dre Harrison, they've been Ryan Eric King, Chris DeHarde, and RJ O'Connell. Till next time, sayonara.
Later, y'all.
Bye.
See you.
Oh man, you know what else would happen if we lose Texas off the calendar? It means less opportunities for a drunken brawl in the Buc-ee's.
Oh,
we're here at Busey's.